Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the future of C# and Visual Basic. My name is Kevin Pilch-Bassan. I'm a software engineering manager at Microsoft on the Visual Studio Languages team. I've been at Microsoft for the last 12 years or so working on C# and VB. I lead a team of developers who are responsible for the IDE experience you get when you use C# or VB, things like IntelliSense and refactoring and coloring and formatting, all of those experiences for C# and VB. In addition to that, being sort of an old timer on the team, I'm a member of the language design committee where we talk about what new language features that we want to introduce. And so the first thing that I want to talk about in this session is kind of what we've been doing for the last few years. And really what we've been working on is opening up the C# and the VB compilers. This is something that we've called Project Roslyn for a long time. And what that's about is we've been re-implementing the C# and the VB compiler. The C# compiler in C#, the VB compiler in VB. And that's kind of an interesting technical detail. But the important part of what that has done is while we were doing it, we designed it to have a rich API, to be an object model into your code, so that third-party people, ourselves, tool vendors who make extensions for Visual Studio, they can have really kind of a high fidelity, accurate picture of what source code looks like, whether it's in a working state, like it compiles, or even with fault tolerance, because when you're editing in Visual Studio, code almost never compiles. And so that lets us build a smarter IDE experience that's built on top of those public APIs. It makes it easier for us to innovate in language features. And because we have a great new code base that we're pretty proud of, it's also open source, which is kind of just something that people expect out of language implementations these days. So we finally went ahead and did that in April. The Roslyn project was kind of our code name internally for a long time. We are now calling it the .NET compiler platform. That's kind of the name for the set of APIs that make up what we call Project Roslyn. So who did we do Roslyn or the .NET compiler platform? Who did we do it for? We really think about three different groups of people that we do it for. First of all, there's the group we call the millions. So that's all developers out there who are using C# and VB today. And what do they get? They get a richer C# IDE experience and a better C# language. The next target audience we talk about is the thousands. So the thousands are people who build source-based tools and extensions, things for Visual Studio, things outside of Visual Studio. If some of you have seen tools like DevExpress's CodeRush, or some of the extensions that you can get in the gallery, Visual Studio 2010 kind of added a new extensibility mechanism that was great as long as you were looking at only text. But as soon as you wanted to do something that required language smarts, well, you pretty much had to write your own compiler to be able to do anything. And a few big companies did that, people like JetBrains and DevExpress, Whole Tomato. They wrote their own C# and VB compilers, basically, to be able to do this tooling experience. What we want to do is we want to kind of lower the barrier to entry and let a lot more people build those kind of extensions and enriched experiences for Visual Studio. Finally, we built it for the tens. That means we built it for us, so that we have kind of a clean code base that we can move more quickly on, we can add new language features more easily, we can add more IDE features more easily, and so that we can partner with other teams to build brand new experiences. How many of you have seen some of the things about the ASP.NET vNext system with its in-memory compilation that's hosted using Roslyn, right? We've been working closely with that team to make sure that they have a great API to enable that kind of developer experience using ASP.NET vNext. And kind of cross-cutting all of these audiences is the fact that it's open source. And that's kind of a key thing for all three of these people, all three of these groups. In particular, for the tens, it means we can take pull requests, we can take external contributions to the compilers and to some of the IDE code to kind of make that a better experience. Now, at this point in time, we're really kind of focused on shipping. to .NET Compiler Platform 1.0. So we're probably not going to take pull requests for giant new language features at this time, because we're trying to kind of lock it down. But once we ship the first version of the compilers that are built on the .NET Compiler Platform, we'll be opening that back up. In the meantime, we're always happy to take pull requests for bug fixes. We have a list of up for grabs bugs, adding additional test cases, all of that sort of stuff we're always happy to take. So that's kind of most of my slides for the day. I want to spend most of the rest of the session doing demos, looking at what some of this stuff looks like. And we're going to look at kind of some of those rich IDE experiences, what it looks like to build and use a custom diagnostic, and then some of the new language features that we've put together. So first thing I want to point out is kind of our home for the .NET Compiler Platform, which you can find on CodePlex. It's rosalind.codeplex.com is the URL. So we have the source code available there. It's under an Apache 2 license, so it's fully open source. We do accept pull requests to the source code. But one of the other things that I think is really interesting to point out is this isn't just Microsoft pushing our code externally for everyone to look at. We're really trying to involve the community, not just in the source code, but in the whole design process. So if I look at this discussions tab, we have a C# language design discussion forum. Every week when the language design committee meets and we talk about possible new language features or revisions to existing proposed language features, we publish the design notes to CodePlex within a couple days afterwards and invite a community discussion about what sort of things we've been thinking about those language features. So I really encourage you to jump in, take a look at the CodePlex site. You can look at how things are implemented, or you can just have an impact on where we're going to go from here. One other thing to point out is we also have a rich source browser. So even if you don't want to clone the code out of Git and take a look at it on your machine and build it, we've built this kind of rich browsing experience that's based in the editor, or based in the browser. And so if I go to source.rosalind.codeplex.com, I can come in here and I can search for something like scan string literal, for example. And I get a fast search of all of the results through the open source code, and I can click on here, and it takes me to the implementation of that method. It's formatted and colored the way you would expect in Visual Studio, but what's kind of really interesting is that every identifier in here is a hyperlink of some kind. And so if I click on a parameter here, all the uses of that are highlighted there. If I click on a method like advanced char, that's like invoking GoToDefinition in Visual Studio. And I navigate to that advanced char method. If I click on it again once I'm at the definition, then that shows me all the references, all the places where that's used. Obviously, this is used a lot in our scanner. So that's kind of a great way to be able to take a look at the code and see what it's doing without having to actually clone it and get into it. So at this point, let's take a look at some of those rich IDE experiences inside Visual Studio. So I'll come over to this little app. It's not a very interesting app. It defines some points and then converts them to JSON and then converts them back from JSON into points and then prints them out. But it'll do to show some of the stuff that we're looking at. So one of the first things is I mentioned that the compiler had been rewritten and the IDE had been rewritten on top of that compiler. So every language-specific experience you see here in C# is built using a public API from that compiler platform. So that helps us show that the compiler API is sufficient to do real-world industrial tasks. It means that it's fault-tolerant and has error recovery built in, because while I'm typing in Visual Studio, when I hit dot and I want IntelliSense to show up, of course my code doesn't compile. I have a saying as an IDE developer that the percentage of time when code actually does compile is pretty much zero, right? That's the boring case. The interesting case is when it doesn't compile. And so we've done a lot of work to build in fault-tolerant heuristics into the code base. But the other thing that we got to do is we re-implemented all of the IDE experiences for C# and Visual Basic. I mentioned that switch to the new editor extensibility model in VS 2010. Well, that happened for the editor team. But for the language teams, we continue to use the older COM-based interfaces to support IntelliSense and all that stuff because we didn't have time to move to it. Well, as part of the Roslyn project, we've actually re-implemented all of those things, and we're using the new editor APIs directly, and that gets us some pretty small but nice benefits. So things like, if I hover and get a quick info tooltip now, well, we put the glyph in it and we do classification, so we make it colored. So that's kind of just a small thing that we look at. If I look at signature help, right, that's also classified now. It's kind of a rich experience. It looks the way you would expect it to. If I look at outlining, if I collapse the outlining region and I hover over it, now I actually get a window into what the code looks like, exactly as it appears in the source. I included the first line, whereas we didn't used to do that. We used to kind of just start with a brace, and now we kind of show you what it is that you're hovering over. So just kind of small improvements throughout that hopefully make it a more pleasant experience to use. There's some new things as well. So you can see here, I don't know how well you can see up there, but system.link in this set of usings is a slightly different color than all the rest. It's kind of partially transparent, and that's an indication that it's not actually used anywhere in this file. Right? So just kind of ambient information about the state of your program. We used to have the remove unused usings command that you could run. Now you can kind of see at a glance whether I need to run that or not. Right? So just kind of surfacing that sort of information. I'm going to show you a little bit more about that using a new language feature. I'm going to jump ahead of myself. But we also, one of the language features that we added is the idea of using a static class. And so using a static class allows me to pull its members kind of into the top level scope. So you can see here I typed using system.console and it immediately got faded out because nothing's relying on that yet. But if I come down here, console also got faded out. And if I put my caret there, then off in the left margin, you can see a little light bulb shows up. And that says, oh, I know something I could help you out with here. And I can hover over the light bulb and see a list of choices, or I can hit control dot to bring up that menu program or with the keyboard. And control dot is kind of our unified way of getting into things the IDE can do to help you out. So we're going to put refactorings there. We're going to put quick fixes there. Control dot is kind of the way to get the IDE to help you do something. So here, I get an option to simplify the type name. And I can just go ahead and say, well, fix all the occurrences of that. And so there, I'm now using the language feature, removed all the uses of console dot. And you can see up here, it's no longer faded out up here because now we actually rely on having that using statement. So that's kind of the set of quick fixes or an example of a quick fix that we have. We've also taken a look at things like our rename experience. We used to have an experience where I could hit F2 and I would get a dialog where I could type a new name and then I could hit OK and it would go rename a bunch of stuff. And we said, that's kind of all right, but we would really like instead to be more in the editor experience. The editor is where people like to be and we want to keep them there more. So if I come in here now and hit F2, you can see that I get three green highlights on the screen. Those are the three references to the thing that's going to be renamed. And I also get this little rename dashboard up here that lets me know that I'm in the middle of a rename. So I can type a new name, and all three references are updated simultaneously. So I can kind of get a quick view of what's going to happen in my file. But as well as kind of the new visual experience that we brought here, we've kind of invested in a pretty sophisticated system to ensure the correctness of our refactorings. And it applies to rename. It also applies to a bunch of our other refactorings. And so if I do some other examples here, let's say I pick a keyword to rename this thing to. So if I type as, well, you can see we've automatically gone ahead and put the at sign there to say, oh, this is a keyword, but you need to escape it in order to be able to use it. If I change it to something that's not a keyword, we recognize that we don't need that. So that's kind of a simple fix up. We also have some more interesting ones. If I rename it to just X instead of underscore X, well then down here, that would conflict with the parameter named X. And so you can see we've automatically gone ahead and qualified it with this dot so that the meaning of your code doesn't change. And we have a whole set of these fixes that we do. We can add braces, insert casts so that overload resolution doesn't change, switch from using an extension method with like an instance to calling it like a static method, and a whole bunch of different ways of resolving conflicts in your code. But it turns out that sometimes there are just conflicts in your code that can't be resolved. And so an example of that is if I rename this field to be the same name as a property in the class, well, now there's unresolvable conflicts. And so it goes ahead and highlights what those unresolvable conflicts are. The rename dashboard up here turns red saying, hey, something's going to go wrong if you do this. But at the same time, we realize that you may have a larger picture of where you're trying to go. And this may be a step that you want to do on where you're trying to go. So we don't block you from doing that. You can go ahead and commit the rename with those unresolved conflicts because maybe that's something you're trying to do. I'm going to go ahead and undo it here. But that's kind of an example of the new inline rename experience that we're building. As well as that, we wanted to add new refactorings. We kind of pushed some refactorings back in VS 2005, and that was a good start. We took some of the big refactorings and tackled them. And then sadly, we kind of languished on that, and we didn't add any more between 2005 and now. And in VB, the situation was even worse. In VB, we added the rename refactoring and none of the other ones. And so at this point, as part of implementing the Visual Basic IDE experience, we have parity in the set of refactorings between C# and VB. And we added a few more kind of bread and butter, every day, all the time refactorings for both languages. So an example of that is that I can select some code, and then I can hit that control dot keyboard shortcut, and I get an option to introduce a local variable now. Whereas before, I had the extract method command, but I didn't have kind of introduce local, which is kind of a bread and butter thing that people do all the time as they're moving around their code. So I can go ahead and extract this. And again, in that unified experience kind of thing that we've done, now we pick a default for the name of the thing that we're going to extract. In this case, we pick it from the type that you're creating it from. So we get a variable named JArray. But if I don't like that, I'm immediately dropped into this inline rename experience. And so I can change the name of that right now. Or if I don't want to change the name of it, I can just hit enter to commit that name. And so we've kind of plumbed that through extract method and when you do event hookup on tab and a bunch of other experiences, we'll kind of drop you into this inline rename experience off the bat. So you have kind of a convenient way to change the name that we generated for you. But at the same time, you stay in the editor more, and you get all the features in the editor that you're used to getting. Last example is kind of a new refactoring that we added that goes hand in hand with that introduce local is the inverse of that, to inline a temporary variable. So I can, again, hit control dot, and I can just put that back right there and get rid of the temporary variable that I had. So that's kind of a quick look at some of the language features, and we're going to talk a little bit more about a few of those later on, but that's a quick overview. The next thing I want to talk about is something that we think is going to be pretty exciting, and that's the idea of custom diagnostics. And so you saw in the example there that the usings were faded out, and that's kind of one example where we've implemented a custom diagnostic. But as part of this object model, we also have an API that allows you to implement your own custom diagnostics. And coupled with that, we have a distribution mechanism that lets you pick up these custom diagnostics through NuGet packages. And so if you're an API author, you can think about not just providing documentation and telling people how they should use your APIs, but you can think about programmatically detecting when they're using them wrong and generating a warning or an error for them in a domain-specific way that's custom to your API. So let's go ahead and take a look at that. I'm going to start over here with some code. This is the code that we're going to run our diagnostic on. It's pretty simple code. But let's say that my team has a rule that says I can't have if statements that don't have braces around them. Right? So here that's a problem. We're clearly violating that. So let's go ahead and take a look at what it would take to implement a custom diagnostic that would let us know if we did that. So I've created over here, a project that uses the extensibility model, that object model that Roslyn offers, to create a diagnostic. And you can get this, should have said that, mentioned this earlier. All these demos that I've been doing today, they're all using the VS14 CTP4 that you can get for a preview. So this is not using VS2013 right now. This is all using the VS14 stuff. So if you get that, then in the gallery, you can actually get an extension that offers new project templates that are specific to Roslyn. And so I can come into this Roslyn node in C#, and I can create a Roslyn diagnostic with CodePlex or with CodeFix. And so that's what I've done. I've just kind of already created one and filled in some of the template stuff. And so you can see I export to the dependency injection system that Visual Studio uses, saying I'm a diagnostic analyzer and I want to run on C# code. I'm interested in looking at syntax nodes, and then I provide some boilerplate stuff. This is kind of category and description. Should be familiar to anybody who's used FXCOP or the code analysis stuff. And the reason for that is that we're kind of integrating this with the code analysis functionality that's provided by FXCOP. So the results go to the same way. The same rule sets can control which of these are enabled and disabled and that sort of thing. So then I provided an ID and an error message format. And I tell it what sort of syntax I'm interested in. So in this case, I'm interested in looking at if statements and else clauses. Right? Those are the two things that we're going to deal with putting braces around. And so this kind of declarative setup of a diagnostic tells the system that we've built to say, let me know whenever you come across an if statement or an else statement. And this happens in kind of a range of environments. It happens while I'm typing in the editor for the current file. It happens kind of slowly in the background for all the files that aren't open in Visual Studio so that I can display warnings in there. If I run on the command line and I pass one of these analyzers into the C# command line option, which we've plumbed through project properties and everything, if I run that, then my command line build also gets an error or a warning. If I'm using team build or Jenkins or any of those other kind of CI systems, all of those errors can be errors everywhere, not just kind of in Visual Studio. So let's take a look at what it takes to implement one of these. I'm implementing an interface that has a method called analyzeNode that gets a syntax node. It also gets a semantic model, which lets us ask kind of interesting questions beyond the syntax, things like this method call, which overload of console.WriteLine did it bind to? Because there's 19. Right? And implementing overload resolution is not something you want to do in your extension. But we've provided this kind of, this object model that lets you just ask questions about the program. So coming in here, I mentioned that this method's going to be called whenever we come across one of those if statements or else clauses that we looked at. So the first thing we're going to do is we're just going to get that. So we'll take the node that we're given and we'll make sure that it's one of those things. Here's another IDE small improvement that we did. We've had for a while the idea of camel case searches in IntelliSense where I can type just the capital letters that are the starts of words. Turns out as we started building Roslyn, writing more C# code ourselves, we found there was a lot of times where that didn't do exactly what we wanted, where there were too many matches or they were in the wrong order. So what we allowed you to do now is not just type all caps to get into that mode, but just type the starts of words. Right? So I can type if STSY, and that does the word breaking at if statement syntax and matches to if statement syntax. So just kind of small things to make your life better. We've kind of thought thoroughly about the IDE experience as we've been building it again. So come in there, and we'll say, we'll make sure that we got one of those. So we'll make sure that it's not null. And then we want to find out, well, what are the conditions where I want to tell the user that they've done something wrong? Well, this is just an object model, like things that you've seen before. So if I look at an if statement, it has a statement. And I mentioned fault tolerance before, so I'm in Visual Studio. Maybe I've just typed the keyword if. And so the parser has recognized that there's going to be an if statement here, but I haven't typed any more than that. So let's check, make sure that's not null as well. And then we'll check what kind of statement is that if statement. And so if it's not a block statement, if it's not a block, well, then we know we want to issue a diagnostic. So there's a couple pieces of information we need to provide to that. The most important one is, where is the diagnostic? It's not a very good error reporting system if it just says there's a problem with your code. So let's go ahead and get the location that we want to report this. And we'll put it right on the if keyword. So we'll take the if statement and we'll get its if keyword. Again, this is just a simple object model. We represent everything that's there, all the tokens, all the white space, all the comments. So if you need to get a location in the source file, it's there. It's represented in the object model. So I take an if keyword and then I create a diagnostic. I have a descriptor. That's kind of the thing that I set up above. I have the location. And this is an if statement. So just like that, I'm going to go ahead and run this program. And I'll get the location of the if keyword, not the if keyword itself. And I'll go ahead and run this program. And what you'll see happen here is once it finishes building, it's going to load another instance of Visual Studio in kind of an experimental set of registry hives and user app data directories with this extension installed in it. And so this is a great way for me to be able to debug the extensions and the diagnostics that I'm working on exactly as they'll show up in Visual Studio. So I'll open that same project that we had before. And a couple seconds later, when our analysis kicks in, we should see some warnings on the if statements and in the error list. Oh, except that I didn't do one step over here. So I created a diagnostic, but I have to tell the system to report the diagnostic. So let's do that and start this again. It does take a second to start Visual Studio each time. To make startup faster, we kind of cache all of the dependency injection stuff. And you'll see that after I build, I change the dependency injection. And so we have to rebuild that cache. But if I open this now that I've told it to report the diagnostic, then you can see we get two green squiggles for the warnings here. And they should show up in the error lists momentarily, too. I'm not sure why they're not there at the moment. But you can see that, so I've already implemented those. And that's kind of all it took to get a warning represented there. I mentioned before, that warning now shows up kind of live in Visual Studio like this. As soon as I type an if statement, it shows up when I build on the command line. It shows up in my team build. So if you're a team that wants to set some policy, this is kind of a great way to do that. And again, if you're an API author, you can also provide guidance about how to use your API. Those of you who have been looking will see that there's also this light bulb over here. And so it seems like we've also kind of figured out how to fix this problem. Well, it turns out that no, we haven't quite figured out how to fix the problem. But we give you some options for how to suppress that warning. So you can kind of make that warning go away in this location. But let's go to the next step. And let's see what it would look like to actually allow the user to fix that problem on the spot. So I'll exit out of that. And the first thing I'll do is add in some code to handle else statements as well. And it's not a lot of code, but basically it's the same pattern that we had for if statements. But I need to add it in the right spot. So again, we're just going to get the else clause syntax, check if it's got a statement. We want to make sure that it works for else if statements. So we check if it's not the statement of the else is not an if statement or a block. And then we report the same thing, except this should say else. OK, so coming over to the other file in the template, there's really not boilerplate through this whole template. There's just the analyzer and the fixer, right, the codefix provider. Those are the only two source code files in this project. So I'm not kind of hiding a bunch of smoke and mirrors and implementation somewhere else to make this easier. So the codefix provider is very similar. I declare that I have a codefix provider. I tell it what diagnostics I know how to fix and what languages I want to operate on. So then, when the user puts the cursor on the line, our implementation of the light bulb will go and ask all of the registered fixers, hey, there's this diagnostic on this line, and you said you might know how to fix that. Can you tell me what your fix looks like for that? And so let's go ahead and look at that. So again, this one gets a few different pieces of information than the analyzer. That's because we rely on fixes running inside Visual Studio. And so they get some higher level services that allow them to do things like formatting and find references and some other functionality that we don't give to analyzers directly because we want them to run in all those scenarios that I mentioned before. So here I'm given a document, but from a document I can get a syntax tree, and then given the position of this diagnostic, I can find the token. So just like before, let's look at the token, or let's get back to our if statement. So the tokens have parents, and we expect this one should be an if statement syntax. So now I have the if statement, and I want to change that if statement to be one that has braces. Well, one of the things that's interesting about the object model that we provide is that it's a totally immutable object model. And so there are no setters on any of the properties in the Roslyn object model. There is no way to change an object once you get one. This makes it slightly inconvenient to work with when you're working on fixes like this, but it offers a lot of advantages to us. It means that we can run analysis in parallel across a whole bunch of threads without worrying that one of those threads is going to go change those objects. It also means that we can have kind of these snapshots of what your solution looks like at different times, and we can use them for interesting things. And I'll give you a taste of what that looks like in a second. So we can't modify this if statement, right? I have if statement, and statement was the thing we were looking at before. Well, it's only got a getter. It doesn't have a setter. So what can I do? Well, I also have this method with statement. And so this is kind of a common pattern in immutable object models. Instead of changing a property directly, I have a method that lets me create a new object with that property changed. So let's go ahead and use that. So we'll say new if statement. Equals the if statement with the statement changed. And how do we want to change it? Well, we want to put a block around it, right? The block was the thing that we were looking for. So we can use a syntax factory to create a new block. So we'll create a block. And what does a block want? Well, it wants the list of statements that go inside of the block. Well, we already have that. That's the existing statement. Right, we just want to wrap it. And so now I have a new if statement. I'm going to do one more thing, which is to hint to the system that we've just changed this code, and so we'd like you to reformat it. So then I'm going to say with annotations, those well-known formatting annotation. So that's just a hint to the system that says, when you're dealing with this, go ahead and format it for me. This is so that we can format just the code that you changed instead of changing your whole file, because you don't want to run a refactoring and have all of your custom formatting on your file changed. And so we kind of poke in here and say, format just this little bit of it. So now I have a new if statement, but that if statement isn't part of my syntax tree. It's not part of anything. It's just an if statement floating off alone. And so I need to get it into the document, into the tree that we're working with. So the first thing I'll do is I'll make a new root. And again, this is an immutable API. So I will use the existing syntax root, and I'll just say to replace that node. So we'll replace the if statement with the new if statement. So now I have a new root, which is almost what I need. But I actually need more than that. I need a document. And so document is kind of our high-level abstraction of a source file that points back to the project it came from and the solution it came from and has a bunch of services like being able to do find references and that sort of thing. So let's get it into a new document. And again, I can just update the syntax root with the new root. And then instead of returning null, I can return a code action. And we have to give it a description. This is the text that goes in that light bulb menu. And I can give it a change document, and it will figure out the rest from there. So let's give it the new document. And then let's go ahead and run this again and see what happens. Assuming I... you can offer multiple different fixes. So that's what's going on here. It's telling me I'm only returning one. So you can offer choices as to how people want to fix a diagnostic. In this case, we're only giving them one choice. So I'll go ahead and run that. And we'll see that same Visual Studio pop up again. And if I open the project that we had there, after we rebuild all the MEF stuff, then we should see the diagnostics show up just like before. There we get the warnings this time. Great. In the warning, in the error list. So we also added the else cases, and so you can see that they're showing up. But if I put my cursor here now, I get that light bulb again. And if I hit Control Dot, I get the fix that we just did. Right? And so that's all it took to be able to offer this quick fix that allows people to fix up their code in Visual Studio. Some of the things that I want to point out here are this kind of lightweight preview about what's going to happen. Right? We generated that for you automatically because you gave us an updated solution. And because it's an immutable snapshot, it's kind of a possible future universe that might take place if you apply this code fix. But because everything's immutable, it's a fully representational snapshot of the world. And we can run all of our analysis on that snapshot just the same as we can the snapshot that's in Visual Studio. And so if you look down here, the if statement in here is actually squiggled. That's because we're running the same diagnostic that you wrote on that preview code as well, even though it doesn't exist anywhere except in this preview window. Right, so this kind of model allows us some really great flexibility. It's a good thing we don't allow hovering or clicking in here, or you could kind of expand infinitely into the preview window. So let's go ahead and apply that. And there you go. We've kind of fixed that issue that we had. So that's kind of what it takes to get started with building one of these custom diagnostics. We think this is going to be huge. Like I said, the kind of packaging with NuGet and providing custom support for your APIs. Imagine if something like JSON.NET or another library that you use had custom diagnostics to say, this string that you're trying to parse as JSON is not actually JSON. Right? The compiler's never going to implement that warning. But why wouldn't something like that do it? So that's kind of custom diagnostics. At this point, let's flip back over to the point example that I used before. And we're going to go through and look at some more language features. And we're going to just kind of walk through this code base and clean it up and see what we can do with some new language features. So as may be evident from the time that I've spent on things, new language features weren't a huge focus for us this release. Right? Our big focus was on getting these APIs right, getting stuff out there. But we also didn't want to go a whole release without changing anything in the languages. And so we did throw in a bunch of fairly small features. And most of our language releases in the past have had a theme. You know, we started out with getting managed code out there. And then we had generics as a theme. And then we had link as a theme. And then we had dynamic as a theme. And then we had async as a theme. Right? So those are all big things. If we had a theme this time, our theme is really around reducing boilerplate code. right? Trying to make it easier for you as a developer. So there's nothing earth-shattering here. There's no huge concepts to take home, but there's some convenience. So we saw one already with the using system.console. Let's come on and take a look at some other ones. So I mentioned that Roslyn, the .NET compiler platform, is an immutable API. Well, one of the problems that we have today is that we make it very easy for you to make a mutable API, an API that you can change, but we make it inconvenient for you to make an immutable API. You have to go through defining kind of fields with accessors and setting things in the constructor, whereas if I wanted to have a regular old object, I could use autoprops, right? So some people will cheat, and they'll kind of use autoprops that have private setters. So that's one approach. So let's start with that. So that gets rid of some of the boilerplate at the cost of, well, now it's not actually an immutable object. You're not communicating your intent anymore. Maybe it's only the people who are maintaining this class, but now they think, well, maybe it's fine to change this thing in other methods, right? Maybe it's okay if I change it. So we've decided, I'll fix up these as well. So we said, let's just allow, one other thing to point out before I get there and get squiggles. This is the next version of Visual Studio. It's the CTP4 version. Not all of the language features are finished being implemented in it. And some of the language features that we'd kind of prototyped in it will probably go away before we end up shipping. So some of the stuff I type is still going to have error squiggles in it because we haven't finished implementing it yet. And some stuff I type may not work once we actually ship. But just to give you a warning about exactly what I'm typing here. So anyway, on the subject of auto properties, we've decided that it makes sense for you to be able to just have read-only auto properties. So I can just leave out private set, and that generates a read-only field in IL, and I can assign to this property in the constructor, and it just does an assignment to the read-only field in the constructor. So it's exactly the same code gen IL that's emitted as what I had before when I had the fields and the local or in the private or the accessors and stuff like that. But I get rid of some boilerplate. In order to allow that, we have to allow assignment to auto properties in constructors, which you can see doesn't actually work in the build that I have here because I have errors there. But we also allow you to give default values up here. Zero is the default, but I can just assign a default value into an auto property. And that works whether it's an auto property with a getter or with a setter or not with a setter. You can now kind of give a default there. So that's one piece. The next thing we look at is kind of these methods and properties that are computations that have to happen every time, but that are really simple, one-line methods with nothing but a return of an expression. Right? There's a lot of ceremony with braces and return statements and all that stuff just to get at what is essentially an expression. And somewhere else in the language, we already kind of give you this option of having just an expression or having braces with more stuff and a return statement. And that's in lambdas. And so we decided that we would extend the same syntax that we have for lambdas into methods. And so I can just use that same lambda arrow that I had before and say, this method just has this for a body. Right? Just return the value of this expression. Computed properties, same thing, right? It's like a method, except it only has a getter because I don't want to put the braces on it. So we said you can go ahead and use the same thing to get rid of the whole setup for the property. And so I no longer have to say that it has a getter separately. I don't have to have any of the braces. I can just say, when somebody asks me for this property, then compute this and give it back to them. Going back up here, we have a math.squareRoot. This is another great example of where I might want to make use of that language feature of using static classes, right? If I'm doing some math-intensive thing, say I'm working on physics or I'm working on, financial modeling where I'm using the functions in system.math a lot, then it's just a distraction to see math dot, math dot, math dot, math dot everywhere in my code, because I know I'm doing math code, right? That's the focus of the code. So I can, once again, just add the math class and say, go away. Oh, it doesn't work yet inside of, the fix doesn't work yet inside of these expression-bodied members that we're talking about. So control dot didn't work there. But I can go ahead and clean that up. Next thing to look at is this string.format example up here. String.format is an API that gets called a whole lot, and it's kind of a pain to use because you have to have these kind of little markers, and then you have to match them up with the thing that you want to put in the marker, and it gets confusing. And it's not cool anymore. All the cool languages have this feature called string interpolation. And so we decided we would go ahead and add string interpolation. This is a language feature that is very much still in the design process. There's 30 or 40 messages a day on the CodePlex thing about what exactly the design should look like. So I'm going to type some stuff here, but it's based on what the proposed design was when I left work on Friday. So it may not actually be like this anymore. But I can come into this string.format call, and I can just get rid of the string.format call. That's not interesting to me anymore. And I can put a backslash before the brace, and that says what comes after the backslash is an expression hole. It's a place where I can type an expression, and so I can just put X here. And same thing here. And so no longer do I have to kind of hunt and match where is the hole that matches with the expression that I'm trying to use. I can just type that expression right in line. We don't have the IDE support for it yet in this build, but it actually drops you out of the color and shows it like a normal expression color. It has IntelliSense and signature help and all that stuff that you would expect for typing the expression right there. That actually works on the build that I have on my machine at work, but this is the public preview that doesn't have that yet. The other thing you can do in string.format calls is you can put in format specifiers. So that actually still works, and justification, right? So I can justify it and put a colon D there to say this is how I want to format it. And we take care of constructing the string.format call for you out of all of that stuff. So that's a pretty handy language feature if you're dealing with strings. So let's move on to this try-get-int method. This method tries to be null resilient. How many of you have dealt with null reference exceptions and nulls in the past? Probably everybody, right? It's always checking for null. That kind of sucks. So we want to make that easier. And so we've added something called the null conditional operator. And this is a way of making it easier to work with null. So let's just get rid of this code here. And we'll change this dot here to a question mark dot. And the question mark dot says, if this is not null, then treat it just like a dot. But if it's null, then the whole expression is null. So don't keep evaluating things over to the right. Just give me back null. And so now, this default case, in here, I can now just say case null and do what I want to do there. In this case, it's the same thing that I want to do in the default. So I can just leave it out. And now I can actually move this out variable down into here, because I've kind of exhaustively covered all of the cases. So that's kind of one simple thing to deal with null conditionals. It works not just there in dots. It also works on indexing as well. So we made that method up there able to handle nulls. And so we can just pass in nulls to it. So I can question mark before the indexing operator and say, if the thing on the left, JSON, if it's not null, then call the indexer. But if it is null, just use null. And so that's kind of a handy way of dealing with nulls. One other thing to mention on this case is a particular use case that we think is really nice for that is invoking events. So I have over here in this other code, I have an event handler for when my repository is closed, and I'm raising this event. So who can see what the problem with this is? Well, the problem is that this closed thing, it could be null, right? And so I can go ahead and I can say if closed is not equal to null, then invoke raise the closed event, right? But the problem now is this is still wrong, because this is not thread safe. You could check that this is not null, and it could be not null, and then between the time when you checked and the time when you raised the event here, somebody could have unsubscribed from the event. And so it can still be null. And so the correct thing you're supposed to do is create a local and assign it into the local and check the local if the local's not null and do that. But we don't have to do that anymore. Because we want side effects to only happen once, we kind of make a local for you automatically when you use the question mark dot feature. And so you can just do question mark dot invoke. And that does the null test, doesn't call the method if it's null, and puts it in a temporary for you because it has to so that it doesn't evaluate the left-hand side twice. And so that's kind of a simpler way to raise events now. So coming back over here to this other file, looking at this toJSON method, we are using a for each loop to populate this J array. And the reason we're doing that is because we need to set things in our JSON object using the indexer. And so otherwise, this is kind of a nice expression-based thing. It'd be nice to use a link query, but I can't because I need statements. And so we said, well, what if you could get at initializers in, or get at indexers inside object initializers? And so I can come over here and create an object initializer. And so that just now calls the indexer each time with each property. And so now I have an object. Now I'm creating this object. I don't actually need this object anymore because I'm not calling methods on it or setting properties on it. So I can come back and use control dot to inline that temporary variable because I don't need it anymore. But I can actually do more cleanup of this method, right? So this method is very procedural right now. It says exactly what to do, how to build this thing. And I would like it to be more declarative. So I'm going to take this code out, and I'm going to rewrite this method kind of the way I want it to be. Turn caps lock off here. So I want to return a JArray, and I want that JArray to say from p in points, where p is not equal to null, select that thing we had before. Oh, a new JArray. And so now I have the same functionality that I had before, but I'm saying what I want it to be, not how I want it to be constructed. Right? And that's all possible because now I can get this into an expression context, and so I can use some of those expression-oriented features like link queries. Moving along, we're going to now look at some interesting code down here. So I have this method for getting a JArray, and this is an async method, and it goes to some repository, and it takes a path. But this is 2014, so paths and file systems aren't cool anymore. We want to use URIs instead. So let's go ahead and rename this parameter to be URI. And so get that great inline rename experience. I rename it to be URI. But the problem is, now someone else on my team comes and uses this method, and they get an argument null exception, and it says that path was null. And they said, well, what's path? There's nothing called path anywhere. And the problem is that this domain-specific knowledge about what is about path is represented as a string, and so the compiler doesn't know anything about that. But we want to look at that. And so what we're adding is a new language feature for getting the name of things programmatically. And so it's called nameOf. And so I can use nameOf path, and that gives me a string constant that's equal to path. Right? So that's kind of silly, right? I could just type quote path quote, except that now I can rename from here, and I know that this refers to the program element called path. Right? And so I can now rename this safely and get exactly the behavior that I want. This is another language design that is currently a pretty hot debate about exactly what it returns. If it's generics, does it return metadata names? Does it return program names? What happens with types? So again, great thing to go get on CodePlex and get involved in the discussion about how exactly this thing will work. We're getting to the end here, and then we'll have some time for questions. But this code has some to-dos in it, because somebody was lazy about error handling. So they have a few to-dos here. So the first one is about only logging exceptions if they happen a certain number of times. So I know how to write that. I can come in here and I can say if e.occurrences is greater than or equal to 3, then throw e. Does that look right to everybody? Well, so there's a problem with that. I'm throwing the exception again, and that means that the stack trace of the exception gets lost, which means that it's harder for somebody to debug what's going on, because as far as they can tell, the exception is now being thrown from this method, not from the method in the repository where it was actually thrown. So I can fix that. I can use the throw statement. That's something that's been there in C# for a long time. And this fixes the stack trace property of the exception that gets thrown, which is great, but it's not actually enough. The problem is that if you're looking at crash dumps, if you're one of the Microsoft partners who signed up to get application reporting problems in crash dumps, this still gives you a crash dump from the place where you do the throw again. It doesn't give you the crash dump at the place where it originally threw, which means you can't see the value of locals. You can't see the value of parameters to that method, which threw. But the CLR has had for a long time an ability to conditionally catch exceptions so that this will work the way you expect it to. And we finally decided to go ahead and expose that in C#. So if I copy this code, I can now just have a catch if. And now I want to change it to less than 3. And so that runs before the exception gets unwound, before the stack gets unwound, before I get to this catch block, as it's looking for someone who can handle a catch block, handle an exception, it says, oh, let me run this little bit of code and see whether you want to handle this or not. And if you say no, I'm just going to keep looking up the stack for a different handler. And so this is kind of a small feature. It's Most of the things that you could do before, but this kind of gives you cleaner semantics as far as what the runtime execution of those are. So that's one example. So next thing we want to do, we want to log this exception. So let's go ahead and use our repository, and we'll say log async. Well, that's great, except that now I have a squiggle under log async. Oh, I have the wrong squiggle, because I have to pass it the exception to log. But now I have a green squiggle still. And the problem there is some compiler mumbo-jumbo about not awaiting expressions and okay, so I'll go ahead and await the expression, except that today you can't, because when we implemented await, we didn't know how to make it work inside catch blocks. And so we just said, you can't await in catch blocks. And so I'll tell you what I usually do to work around that is I just type var t equals, and then the warning goes away and everything's happy, except that I'm not actually waiting for the result of that, right? So if I was a little bit more diligent, then I would instead, outside of my try block up here, create a task, set it to null, and then in here, grab that task, and then down here, after the finally, say if log task is not equal to null, then await log task. Okay, great. So now I'm not lazy anymore. I'm doing the right thing. Except that now I have this to do that says close the repository. So great, I'll close the repository. That's also an async method. And the problem now is I don't know how to fix this, because I don't know why I'm in the finally block. I don't know whether an exception got thrown and I'm on my way up the stack to look for the exception, in which case I can't write any code down here to await that, right? So what do I do? Well, even before we get there, even if I could write code down, so what I generally do is I do what I did before, right? I just make the compiler be quiet. I put it in a task. So great. Now the compiler's happy. Except now I've introduced a race condition. Because down here, I'm waiting for you to finish logging into the repository. But up here, I've already started telling the repository to close. So what happens if the repository finishes closing before I log? Right? So first of all, this is a race condition. Second of all, I can't wait for the await task in the finally, because I don't know where it's going. Well, it turns out, again, so we didn't support this because we couldn't figure out how. But it turns out that async is already some pretty complicated machinery that tracks a bunch of stuff in a state machine and does work behind the scenes so you don't have to. And we figured that we could stash just a little bit more information about where you were going in a catch or an await block or a finally block. And so now you can actually just put await in catch and finally. And so what used to be impossible, at least as far as we were concerned as language designers, is now possible. We figured out how to do it. And so that's a pretty common pattern. If you want to display an error message using a store app, that's an async method. And so you can't even display a message box in your catch handler in store apps today. But now you can kind of go ahead and throw await in there. Last thing is going to be one more look at string interpolation. Partly because I like string interpolation a lot. I think it's a pretty fun feature. But also because somebody gave me this code that tries to build this two-string, and it uses the string builder, and it has a check if it's the first time. And I wanted to pass on this lovely pattern that I've seen, which is instead of tracking firsts and doing all of that stuff, there's actually a method in the framework that does that for you. And so I can just say string.join. So that's all I need for the middle part. And so I can just return a square bracket and then an expression hole for middle and then close square bracket. And that's kind of all I actually need for this method. I put this here in middle as a local because I wanted to get the IntelliSense for string.join and all that stuff. But again, once we have the IDE support lit up for string interpolation, then I can just put this string.join call inside middle here. And we do all the matching of parentheses and quotes, so you can have strings inside of expression holes, inside of interpolated strings. You can even have interpolated strings inside of interpolated strings. And so all of that's kind of taken care of for you. So switching back over to slides, I just have a quick recap. So what did we cover? A lot of stuff. We looked at a rich IDE experience that has the inline rename with the conflict detection and resolution. We looked at adding more refactorings and adding refactorings to Visual Basic in the first place. I didn't do demos with Visual Basic today, but the language feature set varies slightly. But all of the IDE experiences work the same in Visual Basic, and many of the language features work the same in Visual Basic, but with a Visual Basic feel. And if anybody has questions about Visual Basic, they can come talk to me afterwards or with the mic. We took a look at light bulbs to let you fix up your code quickly, right? Some that are built in by us, and then we looked at a bunch of small improvements to the IDE experience. On the VB front, again, how many people work in both C# and VB on a regular basis? Fair number of you. So I do every day, right? I said that the Roslyn code is C# compiler in C# and VB compiler in VB. Well, we did the same thing in the IDEs. So the VB language editing experience is in VB, and the C# one is in C#. So as we started doing this, we said, boy, these are shockingly different IDE experiences for no good reason. And so as we built those language experiences back up for C# and VB, we tried to look at the reason why something happened in each language. And if there was no good reason, we made it the same. We picked what was the best, and we made it the same. If there was a good reason, or if we thought people would have a lot of muscle memory, then we left it the way it was. Because we don't want to break compatibility. We don't want to break your muscle memory. But just kind of stepping back and taking a thoughtful look at every IDE feature and what are the differences between C# and VB means that it's a much more pleasant experience going back and forth between those languages now. So the next thing we looked at were custom diagnostics. Right? We want to make it easy to detect common coding problems. They can run live in the IDE as you're typing. They can be quick fixes. You can add to them as well. They also run as part of command line or continuous integration builds, and they can come along with your library on NuGet. So this is going to be huge. Language features, I kind of highlighted in green what's new on these. I didn't do them in the same order that I did them in the demos, but we talked about the null conditional operator, string interpolation, name of, getter only auto properties. Nothing to highlight in green there because it's just deleting code. Auto property initializers, and a whole nother slide around expression bodied members, using static members, index initializers, await and catch and finally, and exception filters. All right, so that's a kind of a big set of, like I said, small, simple language features to kind of reduce clutter in your code, make it a little bit easier to read. Encourage you to try some of this stuff out with the Visual Studio CTP. You can find it using your favorite search engine. I think I plugged this enough, but come engage with us on CodePlex. There's lots of discussion there. There's source code to look at. There's lively debates about what the APIs look like, what the language features look like, all of that stuff. Some related sessions, which apparently includes this one. So on Friday, I'm giving a talk about C++ scenarios for C# developers. Earlier this morning, Jay Schmelzer gave kind of an overview of a bunch of the stuff coming in .NET. The new JIT systems, .NET Native, all of that stuff. I realize it's over, but these are recorded, so you can go ahead and watch those. This afternoon, I'm going to be in the developer tools area all afternoon. And tomorrow night, I'll be at the Ask the Experts dinner at table 44 if you want to catch me for questions. DevTrack resources, general resources. Please do your eval for me. I'll put this up. And we have about 8 minutes for questions. I have a mic here. If people want to run forward and talk into the mic so it comes on the recording, or people can shout loudly and I'll repeat the question for the recording. If anybody has any questions about any of these kind of areas, the language features, the diagnostics, or the IDE experience. I'm going to stay up here so the camera can see me.
Does this now mean we can do things like my least favorite XAML stroke WinForms problem was talking to the UI and saying, I'm on this thread, do I need to do an invoke? And you end up with this really gruesome piece of boilerplate. Do these things now allow us to fix that kind of thing? Can we just stick an attribute around a method or something that says?
Not directly. That's kind of a idea to put an attribute around things. It kind of gets at a set of language features that we call metaprogramming, right? Which is having code which changes your code as part of the compiler process. That's something that we think is very interesting, but in the spirit of actually being able to ship this thing in a reasonable time frame, we decided we weren't going to start building that yet. We also aren't sure that we know how to build it the right way, and so we want to see what experiments people do with the APIs that we put out there. And I know there's various people who started building experiments about what they can do with metaprogramming. And so we'll probably circle back and look at what those are and see if there's anything that the community's built that does kind of what we want it to do, and look at that for a later version of the language. But we didn't directly tackle metaprogramming this time.
But we can now at least write a diagnostic, spot it, and fix it.
Yes. You can have the design time experience of finding it and fixing it easily. You don't have the build time automatically fixing it for you. Sorry, I heard an improvement at the language level 4, and I didn't hear the word after that one.
Just to know if you're planning any improvement at language level for WPF, like implementation of enotify property change or dependency properties and things like that.
So I didn't go through it, but we don't have anything directly in there. But the combination of the caller member name attributes that we added in the last version and the name of feature that we added in this version actually allow it to be a lot better than it is today. So if you're looking at creating a dependency property, you have to specify the name of the type and the name of the property and all that stuff. So you can use name of to do that now and get IntelliSense and get refactoring across those things. We haven't actually reduced the boilerplate for it, although that's kind of the canonical metaprogramming example that people usually come to us with is I want to do auto-notify property changed through dependency injection or through rewriting. So we haven't directly tackled that one. We've made it easier to do the existing stuff. And one of the samples that we actually have is a refactoring that we added that allows you to transform a property into an iNotify property change compliant property or into a dependency property. And so again, looking this time at kind of the tooling experience as opposed to the language experience. Anyone else? Yep.
I was asking about that feature name of. So what names can you get? Like the name of the class, the name of the executing method as well?
So basically, the principle that we have is that if the language has a name for something, then you can get that name for it. So it can be a parameter, it can be a method, it can be a class, it can be a namespace. If it exists, if it's something that has a name, you can get it. What are things you can't get names of? You can't get names of things like constructors because the language doesn't specify a name for it. You can't get the name of an operator. You can't get the name of, and this one is up for debate in CodePlex, you can't get the name of a keyword like int because according to the language, that's not a name, that's a keyword. Right? And we didn't put it in because we have a principle that whatever you put in name of, the last part of the name that you put in name of, is the string that comes back. And so does that mean if you put name of int, would you get int32 or would you get int? And if you got int, is it actually useful? Because you can't actually communicate with anybody who's not using C# if it's int. But if it's int32, then it doesn't match what you typed in the name of. And so right now we said no keyword types, just actual type names.
Thank you.
No problem. Yeah.
Question about this name of feature. Can we use it in attributes?
Yes.
Okay, and is there any plans to create just strong type reference to property info in metadata, not just name of it?
So the question is, can we get property info from metadata? This is a feature we've been talking about for 5 years or so. But we call it the info of property, or as former teammate Eric Lippert used to call it, the infoof operator. We're not adding info of right now. One of the problems with info of is that you have to teach the compiler which specific overload of a method you want. And we don't really have a great syntax for specifying that right now. We have the way that overload resolution normally works is by having a bunch of arguments of specific types. But we don't have, like, we don't really want you to have to type arguments of instances of things in an info of call. And without that, we can't pick which method if it's an overloaded method. So that's kind of been the thing that's been blocking us from that. I don't think we'll add it in C# 6. But as we've worked on the design of name of, we've had a couple of ideas for syntaxes for that. And so we'll probably keep noodling on it. And it might be something that comes in C# 7. If it's something that means a lot to you, I would suggest engaging on CodePlex and talking to us about it on the design discussions.
Okay, and one more question about this null conditional operator. If we use it for invoking events, is it safe now or is it just sugar syntax for storing this local variable and invoking it?
It is syntactic sugar for storing the local variable and invoking it.
So it's not thread safe.
It's thread safe the same as storing a local variable is.
Yeah, but it's not in case we have application that invokes events too often and we have other object that unsubscribes from event. So we still can get situation that object unsubscribed but got notification.
Well, certainly there's definitely a race condition where on one thread you think you've unsubscribed but you have but you still get the event. That's just the way that threading works in that, those kind of cases, right? Because the effects are observable in different orders. What you can't have happen anymore is you can't have a null reference exception at the invocation of the event because the event has gone to null between the check.
Yeah, and is there any plans to do events thread safe in easy manner that I described earlier?
I'm not aware of any plans to change event.
Okay,
I think I'm 2 minutes over. I'll come stand down here if people want to ask me questions off of the recording. But other than that, thank you very much for coming out.